You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 25th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Hobby Lobby heads to the Supreme Court to argue that as a corporation headed by a religious person, they do not need to subscribe to U.S. law if it offends their religious sensibility. Dahlia Lithwick from Slate will be here to outline us the legal aspects of this case. Also on the program today, another senator. Democratic senator comes out for expanding Social Security and is running on it. Is it a senator from New York State? I mean, must be some true blue liberal state. In fact, no. Also on the program today, new report shows that mortgage tax breaks for you folks getting a mortgage interest deduction, not only are you on the government dole, but you're also probably just using it to buy a bigger house. Also, the unemployment crisis will be hitting, converging with the foreclosure crisis coming to a neighborhood near you. And New York Times reports that a report that they haven't seen completely exonerates Governor Chris Christie. Case closed, don't need to worry about it. Apparently the report was in part overseen by somebody who goes on family trips with Chris Christie. Why should that be a problem? President Obama comes out with a proposal to reform NSA bulk surveillance. We will talk about that as well. And new report that shows, and this is going to come as a shock to a lot of you, apparently when you spill tons and tons of oil into the water, it starts to affect the fish. I know that's going to be shocking. And before we get to Dahlia Lithwick, we tried an experiment over the weekend where we allowed for voicemails from listeners. We got one voicemail, and we probably won't do it anymore. When you hear this voicemail, it's some crazy, it sounds like some crazy old guy just leaving a bizarre, nonsensical voicemail. We figured we'd play it just to give you a sense of probably why we won't do this in the future. Here it is.
This administration, the White House and the State Department, have failed to get a status of forces agreement. A trained ape could get a status of forces agreement. It does not take a genius. And we have so mismanaged that relationship.
Well, there you go. I don't know. He just seemed to start and end, but we probably, hopefully, will going to put a block on our phone so that crazy old coot won't be able to call us again.
You have no idea who's listening to us. That
no.
does not sound like our typical listener, but
no,
clearly
it doesn't.
He felt passionately.
I feel like I recognize the voice, but I can't place it. I'm not sure. Maybe the guy's called in once or twice. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dahlia Lithwick. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program, contributing writer at Slate.com, Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Sam.
Now, you're in Union Station in D.C. now, avoiding the snow, and apparently the protest there outside of Hobby Lobby. Just give us a sense of what's happening in terms of the protests.
Just wall to wall on the front plaza of the Supreme Court this morning since about 8:30 and dumping snow, Sam. You know, women, chiefly women, Planned Parenthood and other women's organizations, just standing on the front of the court, just shouting, in effect, my boss shouldn't be deciding my health care, my boss shouldn't be deciding about my insurance. So it's been, it's a scene there. And so, yes, very loud.
All right. So let's, that gives us a hint of what this case is about. But go back and tell us what questions are being debated at the Supreme Court in regards to Hobby Lobby.
Well, so both Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, these are two different cases. They come up, one comes up through the Oklahoma courts and the federal appeals courts there. The other one comes up through Pennsylvania, and each of them says that under the ACA, the Obama healthcare mandate, they are forced to provide insurance that includes contraception, and that for different reasons, for one group is Mennonite, the other are evangelical Christians, and for different reasons, they both feel that those are abortion-inducing drugs, and they don't want to provide them for their employees, and they bring up claims under both the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause, and they bring up arguments under RFRA, which is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in effect saying the government cannot compel me to violate my dearly held religious beliefs in order to give women abortion-inducing drugs. So that's more or less what the two cases are, and the court hears both of the two cases this morning in a, by the way, extended argument. Usually argument lasts for an hour. Today it was a 90-minute argument, and the court heard those two arguments this morning.
Okay, and so before we talk about what you know what was actually argued today specifically, let's go through some of the aspects of this. There is not really a contraception mandate here, right? There is simply a mandate as to what health insurance must include. Neither one of these companies are obligated to offer health insurance, are they?
That's exactly right. And this is an argument, I think it's been more and more known as the Marty Lederman argument. He's a law professor who's been blogging away on the blog called Balkanization, saying this is not a mandate any more than the ACA case was a mandate. All of these employers have the option to not give their employees any health insurance, sort of have them find insurance on the exchanges, and they pay a penalty. So he's saying, look, this is not coercion. This is not compulsion. They can simply pay the tax, and that word gets thrown around today, and not get involved in this at all. So, you know, the idea that there's a contraception mandate, that rhetoric, I think that you've heard the left push back on that more and more and say, there's no mandate here. There is absolutely a choice to just stay out of the insurance business and avoid the whole problem.
All right, let's talk about the other aspect that seems to be debated, but science, I think, would have an argument that there really is no debate here, and that is that the what is included in terms of health insurance? And there is a mandate insofar as the health insurance is required to offer certain health procedures and health benefits and wellness benefits to qualify as being actual health insurance. But there's none of what is included in the regulations imposed on health insurance under the Affordable Care Act involves abortion at all, does it?
Well, so this is part of the sticking point here. It's clear that the ACA as written wasn't going to force anyone to provide abortions. That was, you know, litigated and argued and it's done. But of the 20 devices or medicines that are deemed contraceptive care that are necessary for women to have contraceptive care, there are 20 different contraceptive methods or devices. And of the 20, different religions are going to object to different things. So even as between these two cases today, we have one group that opposes, you know, Ella, and that's Ella is kind of known as the week after pill, Plan B, the morning after pill, and two different IUDs. Another plaintiff in this case objects to only three. We had a plaintiff, a Roman Catholic plaintiff, who objects to all 20 devices or methods because they say all 20 of these contraceptive devices are, in fact, abortifacients or abortion-causing drugs. So one of the issues you get into is different faiths draw the line among these 20 different devices at different places. But I think your underlying question is, do any of these, do the medical community or the scientific community think any of these causes abortions? And of course, the medical community says they don't, because if they caused abortions, they wouldn't be covered in the first place.
All right. So with those two sort of questions resolved, let's get to the matters. And I guess those are sort of more matters of fact than of law. In this instance, the plaintiffs are arguing that in one case it's the First Amendment, and in another case it is a statutory they're sort of hanging the hat on the statute, the religious freedom free exercise clause. Let's talk about the First Amendment claim, and before we even do, what implications do we have, or do we have any past examples of these type of cases where we're talking about a for-profit corporation as opposed to a nonprofit that is either primarily a religious organization or is run by a religious organization?
Well, there's certainly lots of case law that have to do with religious corporations. And there's also lots of case law, notably Citizens United, that have to do with for-profit corporations or all corporations that are afforded speech rights. What's radically different here is, I think what you're asking, there is no case law that says that for-profit corporations have the right to exercise religion. So what's really the nut of this case and what's quite dramatic about what the complainants are seeking is that they are saying, look, the same way that we have free speech rights as corporate entities, we are also persons for the purposes of RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We are people in terms of the ability to exercise religion as well. And that's one of the issues, you know, that I think folks thought would get much more attention today at the court. It got a little bit of attention at the court. But as to your initial question, there are, in one case, we have Hobby Lobby, and that's chiefly the RFRA. So that's the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Those are the statutory claims that say that this 1993 statute that says that Congress cannot pass laws that burden a person's religious exercise unless there's a compelling interest. This is important, a compelling interest and a less restrictive way of getting the affording those benefits doesn't exist. So that's RFRA. The other thing is, as you said, the First Amendment protections of religious freedom. And that's what comes up in the Conestoga, the Pennsylvania cases. So they were kind of mushed together in argument today, mushed together in some of the thinking about this case. But they are distinct arguments. And I should add that about the first 20 minutes of oral argument, where Paul Clement was defending the religious objectors in this case, almost all of that went to this statutory discussion around RFRA of whether we could extend the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to include for-profit corporations. So we spent an enormous amount of time today at argument thinking about RFRA and whether it could apply in these cases.
I want to turn to RFRA in a second, but do you think that part of the reason why the First Amendment argument wasn't highlighted had to do with the fact that the RFRA in many respects came out of a case at the Supreme Court regarding the First Amendment and a peyote case. Can you just give us a little bit of background on that and where that sort of leaves the terrain to the extent that folks like you read the tea leaves?
Right. So the most important case you need to think about in order to understand how this gets framed at the court is the 1990 case you're talking about. This is Scalia writing in a case called Employment Division versus Smith. And this is a case where two folks who are charged with drug laws say, no, we weren't just smoking drugs. We were smoking peyote. And it's because of our dearly held religious faith. This was a religious ritual. And Scalia writes the opinion that says, no, the First Amendment doesn't just offer religious exemptions to anybody who comes along and says, oh, I was doing this for a religious reason. Scalia says, you know, generally applicable laws must be enforced. And we can't, in effect, make every single person in America a law unto herself and have her determine that in this case, my religion says I can do it regardless of what the law says, because first of all, as he says, everyone will be claiming religious exemptions. And second of all, it puts courts in this untenable position of having to make judgments about, is this in fact a heartfelt matter of faith or is it pretextual? So after Scalia wrote that opinion in Employment Division, and you're quite right to say this is the paradox of this case, is that it's a Scalia law that triggers all this. In 1993, Congress passes RFRA in response to this. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act tries to take life back to the pre-employment division doctrine, and it says, pretend Smith didn't happen, pretend Scalia didn't write that case. We are going to revert to a time where we look at government burdens on a person's religious freedom using strict scrutiny. So that's the highest constitutional standard that you can use to evaluate. So it returns us to there, and it really bolsters the idea that Scalia had undermined in Smith, that, listen, even neutral, generally applicable laws, if they have effect of burdening someone's religion, the government has to come back and show there's a compelling interest and there isn't a less restrictive way to achieve those ends.
So when we turn to RFRA and we talk about Hobby Lobby, the first question is it possible to burden an individual's religious beliefs if they're a corporation?
That's exactly right. And that issue, as I said, you know, that got tons and tons of press leading up to the case. There was an enormous amount of discussion of, you know, do corporations pray? Do corporations have bar mitzvahs? Almost no discussion of that. A little bit of discussion of that today. But really, I think even Don Verrilli, who is the Solicitor General, and you'll by now notice that the two oral advocates in this case are Paul Clement and Don Verrilli. They were the people who argued the healthcare cases. But even Don Verrilli conceded that persons can be persons for both First Amendment and RFRA purposes, and they can be corporations. That's okay. His problem was religion. Can they exercise religion? And so actually, both sides were, I think, almost willing to say that corporations can be people and they can raise all sorts of objections, including civil rights objections, but practicing religion is different. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor was the one who over and over again looped back to explain to me how a corporation exercises religion. Is it 51% of the shareholders? Is it two-thirds of the shareholders? What if the shareholders feel differently about it? How does a corporate structure that is by definition not an amalgam of the people who run it practice religion?
Okay, and so once that question is addressed, the next question that comes up is what? Whether or not this actually imposes a burden? Or is it that weighing it against the government interest in making sure that insurance works for everybody?
Right. I mean, one of the things that underlies this entire discussion today is, look, there are third parties who are being harmed by this. And what Don Verrilli tried to argue over and over again is this isn't just a case where the employer's rights are at issue. There's another set of rights here, and it's all the employees of the company. You know, don't forget, in Hobby Lobby, it's 14,000 employees, many of whom don't share the faith of the corporation or the corporate owners. What about their right? The ACA gave them a right to have certain contraception paid for, and those rights are being burdened. And what Don Verrilli said over and over and over again at argument this morning is it's one thing for an individual or even a corporation to assert that they have religious rights, but those rights are against the government. What do you do when there's a third party whose own rights are being burdened? In this case, all the employees, their rights are being burdened. And Verrilli says there's never been a case where you can say my religious objections mean that I can burden the rights of tens and thousands, you know, of other people who work for me.
So that's when we hear people refer to the RFRA as a supposedly functioning as a shield as opposed to a sword.
That's exactly right. One of the ways that people have come to talk about this argument, and by the way, this is an interesting brief that comes out by a bunch of law professors who are thinking about what RFRA really means, and they say RFRA cannot be used as a sword to trammel the religious freedoms of everybody else. And so, you know, then it becomes a violation. RFRA itself becomes a violation of the First Amendment. And so this idea that RFRA was meant to protect you from government harm shouldn't be giving you a sword, to go after your employees and say, you know, I don't really care what your health care needs are, because I my religious objections trump them.
So this is sort of that classic case of like your rights end at my nose. In this instance, it is your rights end at my health, I guess.
Well, and that's, you know, Don Verrilli tried to say that in his very first seconds of his opening statement. And Chief Justice John Roberts, and don't forget, everyone's eyes are on John Roberts because he was the fifth vote in the health care cases, voted with the liberal side of the court. But he was the one who said, no, that's just not a correct characterization of the world. Post-RFRA, your rights don't end when you start burdening other people's rights. And the whole point of RFRA is to protect you. So one of the things that people were watching today, they were certainly watching John Roberts. They were certainly watching Anthony Kennedy. It was very clear Justice Scalia, regardless of his opinion in Employment Division in 1990, Justice Alito are clearly, clearly, strongly aligned with the interests of the corporations. But it was interesting to watch Justice Roberts during oral argument quite skeptical of the arguments being made by the government to defend the contraception requirements.
What else did you notice during the course of the arguments that made an impression on you?
Well, I think the overwhelming thing that probably we all noticed was the argument on the part of the right wing of the court that more or less said, look, the Obama administration says there's a compelling interest in a contraception ban, and then they turn around and they grant exemptions left, right, and center to anybody, right? They grant an exemption to the not-for-profit religious organizations. They grandfather in every Tom, Dick, or Harry. So once they're throwing around exemptions, they can't really take the position that there's a compelling interest in affording women contraceptive care because they've exempted everyone out of it. And Justice Kennedy, who, as I said, is the one that all eyes were watching, took this one step further. Justice Kennedy said, not only is the government going around granting exemptions, but it's HHS. It's an agency that's running around granting exemptions. In other words, Congress didn't write these exemptions into the Health Care Act. And so once you find Congress in the posture of saying, oh, you know, we're exempt this guy, we're going to exempt that guy, then there's clearly no compelling interest. The other thing that I thought was very, very interesting today was the extent to which there was at least some traction for the idea, what you said at the beginning. Hey, this isn't a mandate. This isn't a penalty. This is a tax. It looks a lot like the healthcare cases. And if employers can, without losing too much money, simply say, you know what, we're going to opt out of the insurance business altogether, then maybe we can construe this as, you know, not a mandate, not a penalty, and no religious rights or burden. So I think it's going to kind of come down to a foot race, Sam, between whether you can get five votes to make the case go away by saying, hey, this isn't a mandate, this isn't a penalty, or if you can get five votes to say, this is simply a religious burden, and we know there's no compelling interest for contraceptive care because the government has granted exemptions to everyone.
Is there an opportunity for, let's say, just hypothetically, an employee of Hobby Lobby, assuming the court finds that on these grounds there has not been established a competing interest by the government in a sufficient way as to say why Hobby Lobby, this must be offered in that health insurance, and they do find that the idea of not getting health insurance is too much of a burden on Hobby Lobby. Is there an opportunity for a plaintiff to come from the employees of Hobby Lobby to come back and say, now, wait a second, just as Hobby Lobby was found to be coerced into having health insurance, I'm coerced into having a job with subpar health insurance that wouldn't exist if I was existing at a company that respected my religious beliefs that contraception is okay.
So the case that the government has going into this oral argument today is this case called United States versus Lee, and it's a case from 1982, and the language is pretty darn persuasive, and the court effectively says, quote, when the followers of a particular sect enter into commercial activity as a matter of choice, they can't go ahead and superimpose their religious views. In other words, they're a commercial entity. They are no longer religious people. Now, one response to that argument is, hey, this is pre-RFRA, so it doesn't matter. The other response, and we heard it a lot today, and I should tell you that was a case in which an Amish farmer was objecting to paying Social Security taxes because he said it violated his beliefs. And in that case, in assessing that case and analyzing that case, the court brings up exactly your point, which is his employees suffer, right? There are these third-party burdens that we've talked about. And so once third parties are burdened, you know, that's a whole different matter. Then you're in the world of United States versus Lee. In this case, there isn't a lawsuit by the employees at Hobby Lobby, and maybe it would be different if they were in the case. So I think you're quite right. That's the logical extension. If you're going to hang your hat on the idea that these women have a right to contraceptive devices, then one of them may have to come forward in a future case and say, my right is being burdened by my boss's religious convictions. That was one of the distinctions they drew today between Lee, which in many ways would seem to just resolve this case, and between Hobby Lobby. So you'll have to, you know, ask when that case happens and how that happens. And obviously it will be very, very driven by what happens today. The other thing, you know, that was simmering under everything we talked about today was the Little Sisters, was the nuns and the religious schools, the churches and the hospitals that are suing in a different litigation. Because don't forget, they got an accommodation. The government said to them, check this box, sign this paper. You don't have to give contraceptive. It becomes the insurer's problem. And they're declining to do that as well. One of the very interesting subtexts of today's argument was, would Hobby Lobby and Conestoga accept that kind of accommodation? And Paul Clement was almost forced to answer that question today.
Interesting. And so what are the implications? I mean, you know, I guess it depends on how sort of narrowly the question is addressed. But I mean, what are the implications down the road? I mean, it seems that it could open the door to just, you know, I guess a lot of what Scalia said in his opinion in that 1990 peyote case, which is that, you know, this could just there could be no end to this.
Right. And Justice Sotomayor made that point. Justice Kagan made that point. They said, what about employers who object religiously to vaccination? What about employers who object religiously to civil rights laws? What about employers who deeply heartfelt religious objections to blood transfusions and AIDS treatments, all of which exist? The answer that Paul Clement gives is, oh, good grief, don't you think all those folks would have come forward already? Why is it that we don't have those lawsuits every day, even though RFRA was passed in 1993? It's just not going to happen. Now, the response on the other side is, it's not going to happen because it hasn't happened. You've never offered this theory of what RFRA includes. In other words, by saying that a religious objector can come to the court with a claim that they have a deeply held religious conviction, the court can't test the legitimacy or the sincerity of the conviction. They have to just accede that it's true and then subject it to scrutiny, right? The highest level of scrutiny. Of course, everyone in the world is going to come forward and say, I object. And Paul Clement's answer was, well, when you start seeing people claiming to have religious objections to things that will save them millions of dollars, you should really worry about it. But up until that point, we sort of need to assume those religious objections are legitimate and should be honored.
How does he say that with a straight face? I mean, isn't it the case that Hobby Lobby didn't even realize that their insurance was providing this? I mean, these are plaintiffs who were solicited to join this case. I mean, how can he with a straight face say, well, nobody showed up yet? I mean, that's just simply because there wasn't a political activist group that was going around saying, we will finance your lawsuit.
Well, and, you know, Justice Sotomayor, Sonia Sotomayor, did make the point today at oral argument that, you know, wait, wasn't the Hobby Lobby for this contraception provision until they were against it? You know, because they did provide it until they changed it, and they changed it after Obamacare came into effect. So certainly I think there is the argument that this is politically motivated. But for the court's purposes, you know, the truth is that's obviously not going to matter. What matters is the court saying, you know, you give us this slippery slope of the Jehovah's Witnesses and, you know, the other religious groups that come in and have religious objections. We will give you the other slippery slope, and this one is best articulated by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who, as I said, all eyes are on Kennedy, and Kennedy says, hey, you know what? What's to stop the government from mandating that every employer pay for abortions? Because if you're willing to pay for things that look like abortions and many people believe to be abortions, then can't the next step be that the government forces everyone to provide abortions? And so there's, you know, slippery slopes on the other side as well. I have to say Don Verrilli had a hard time answering the question, what would you do with a statute much like the one in Denmark that purports to be simply an animal rights statute that precludes anyone from slaughtering meat in a kosher or halal way? Are you saying those corporations have no rights? Can you force those corporations to slaughter meat in ways that violate their religious conscience? So I'm afraid the slippery slope goes both ways. And if you're counting noses, it looks like Anthony Kennedy might be the fifth vote for the slippery vote slope that says you're a short hop from making people provide abortions against their religious beliefs.
And so, and broadly speaking, I mean, aside from the fact that we're talking about the, and this is no small aside, but denying a hundreds of thousands of women access to affordable health care in terms of contraceptives, and there's plenty of data that show the implications of that on women's health down the road. But this doesn't have any really broader impact on the Affordable Care Act in terms of its functioning in other areas.
Right. The only provision that gets called into question today, the only thing is that is on the table is whether this contraception provision can be forced on people in their parlance who don't want it. So the rest of the act goes forward, although I should say that Don Verrilli makes the point in oral argument today that if you gut this provision, you know, having gutted the Medicaid expansion and gutted other provisions, you make it harder and harder and harder for the act to function in a uniform way across the country, which, of course, was entirely the point.
Right. All right. Well, Dahlia Lithwick, I mean, is there anything else you think that we should know on this?
The only thing else I would say, Sam, is that I think if Chief Justice John Roberts wants to do what he did last time around, which is find a way to go small or go smaller and not open the door, as you say, to, you know, every religious objector gutting general laws in America. One thing he said today, and he may get five votes for this proposition, is let's just decide this case about the Green family and the Han family, right? These are closely held family corporations, tiny little corporations, and wait for another day to see if Google or, you know, Starbucks takes this posture. So there is a middle way out of this case if the court wants to find it. It's not a particularly good result, obviously, for the women of America who want contraception. But one way to sort of make an intermediate stand and wait for the big case is to say, look, corporations are people, too, for religious purposes, but only in the case of deeply religious families and closely held corporations.
Well, I mean, this is, I for one, I'm not sure I buy the slippery slope argument on both sides, but I suppose everything can be a slippery slope if you want it to be, right?
Anything can be a slippery slope, and maybe most pointedly, you know, I think once you insert courts into the business of deciding whose religious convictions matter, whose are deeply held, how are they burdened, how do you test what their burden? This is a thing that courts are so astonishingly ill-suited to do. And kind of the point of employment division was that courts were going to get out of the business of second-guessing people's relationships with God. I think today it's fair to say whether the court sides on one side or the other, they're right back in that business.
Well, thank God we have all those non-activist judges in the majority on the Supreme Court. I'm sure they will make the right decision. Dahlia Lithwick, contributing writer at Slate.com. Thanks so much for your time today. Always a pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to take a brief break. I don't know what has happened to voice got a little raspy over the weekend. We're going to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will get just giddy over who is running for re-election to the Senate on expanding Social Security. That's going to be hilarious, almost as hilarious as to find out what happens to fish when apparently they suck up oil as tiny baby fish.
See, the first one was ambiguous, and now you're just going straight into the Sam Cedar not funny.
Sense of, is not funny? We don't have a lot of funny stories today, but maybe we can make them funny.
I think if you add Scott Brown to pretty much anything, there's a humor factor.
That's true.
Yesterday when we were covering Erdogan shutting Twitter down, we turned him into Andrew Dice Erdogan. There's a lot of different lot of different variables. Yep. Yeah.
I'm sorry I missed that. That must be at least partially an explanation for the loss of members yesterday that we had. Now,
you made that too obvious. But now go make the pitch.
Folks, you can become a member and push back against the backlash, against the Erdogan Dice Clay that the show has been subjected to by going to majority.fm and becoming a member today. Your support helps make this show possible day in, day out. You know, we have members who write me and they say, you know, right now I'm going through a period where I can't listen to the show as much as I want to, so I don't listen to as many of the second halves as I want, but I know in the future I'm going to want to, so I'm keeping my membership open so that I know the show is still there when my schedule dies down a little bit. And then I write back, that's a very nice thing to say. You can also support this show if you buy junk from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap from there. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's fair trade coffee, and it's delish. How's that for leading into the fun half? I'm gonna shorten everything I say.
Delish.
Yeah, whatevs.
Very good.
646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We also will take your IMs at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey.